Good afternoon. And my name is Dean Reuter, and I'm the director of the Federalist Society's practice groups. And I'm happy to welcome you here today to the Federalist Society program on the Securities Litigation Attorney Accountability and Transparency Act, S-3033. We're going to hear first today from Senator Cornyn, who will speak and then take questions from the audience. After he departs for a 2:30 hearing, we're going to hear additional remarks with an additional opportunity for questions from Senator Cornyn's chief staffer on this legislation, Holt Lackey, and also from private attorney Andrew Pincus of the Mayor Brown Law Firm here in Washington. We're very privileged to have with us the distinguished senator from Texas, John Cornyn. Senator Cornyn is a sponsor of the legislation we're discussing today. Of course, he is no stranger to discussions of the law. Having served 6 years as a district court judge and 7 years on the Texas Supreme Court, Senator Cornyn then took up the post of Texas Attorney General. Having interpreted and enforced the law in those positions, Senator Cornyn moved on to helping write the law as a member of the U.S. Senate. He has served with great distinction on the Senate Judiciary Committee, which oversees all federal courts, and whose jurisdiction ranges from criminal justice to intellectual property to antitrust. From his seat on the Judiciary Committee, Senator Cornyn has worked tirelessly to reform the judicial nomination and confirmation process to uphold the integrity of the Constitution and respect for the rule of law. He has been a stalwart and vocal supporter of President Bush's judicial nominees, and he has been and continues to be a great friend to the Federalist Society. And on behalf of the Federalist Society, it's my pleasure to welcome Senator Cornyn.
Thank you, Dean, and it's great to be with members of the Federalist Society. Ever since the Bush administration came into office, there are those who, on the Judiciary Committee, mostly on the other side of the aisle, who have this probing question: are you now or have you ever been a member of the Federalist Society? And if you are, you are immediately suspect in their eyes. But frankly, I admire the Federalist Society for many reasons. Your scholarship, the intelligence of the members, the fact that you're not afraid to debate your principles and point of view. To me, that's an important and unique contribution that the Federalist Society makes. I also would have to add my daughter, who's just finished her second year at University of Texas Law School, is a proud member of the Federalist Society in Austin, Texas. They need more members in Austin, Texas, I have to tell you. Which is the most liberal county in the state, Travis County. But I want to start. I know we're going to talk about securities class action, and I want to discuss that, but I also want to give you a chance to ask a few questions. But I also want to read to you a couple of paragraphs out of the United States Supreme Court decision today in the Louisiana death penalty case, in case you haven't had a chance to see it. This is from Justice Alito's dissent, and of course, Justice Kennedy favored us with another travesty of the law just recently in the involving Guantanamo Bay and the writ of habeas corpus. And today has penned another one. This is Justice Alito, how he describes the decision. He said, "The court today holds that the Eighth Amendment categorically prohibits the imposition of the death penalty for the crime of raping the child. This is so, according to the court, no matter how young the child, no matter how many times the child is raped, no matter how many children the perpetrator rapes, no matter how sadistic the crime, no matter how much physical or psychological trauma is inflicted, and no matter how heinous the perpetrator's prior criminal record may be." The court provides two reasons for this sweeping conclusion. First, the court claims to have identified a, quote, national consensus that the death penalty is never acceptable for the rape of a child. Second, the court concludes, based upon its, quote, independent judgment, close quote, that imposing the death penalty for the child rape is inconsistent with, quote, the evolving standards of decency that mark the progress of a maturing society. That's stunning, frankly, to me as a recovering judge and a lawyer for the last 30 years at the Supreme Court. I guess stunning, but maybe not surprising, is the way to put it. The United States Supreme Court, of course, is the court of last resort. They are the final interpreter of what the Constitution means. That doesn't mean we have to agree with it, and I certainly don't in that case. And I think, unfortunately, the court has taken upon itself to interpret the Constitution basically as a policymaker and not as a interpreter of the fundamental law of the land. Okay, enough on that subject for now. I wanted to talk to you a little bit as this is billed is about securities litigation reform. And I have a confession to make. In the 30 years or so that I've been a lawyer, I've never handled securities litigation, but I have handled and presided over class action litigation. And basically the principles that we're going to be talking about here, I think, would apply with equal force to basically any class action lawsuit. I think the court, the legislation that I want to talk about, of course, grows out of some recent celebrated abuses of the fiduciary relationship that a lawyer has to the client. Of course, in a class action lawsuit, you have a class representative, and none of the ordinary sort of safeguards that apply to make sure the lawyer is not just representing their own point of view or their own financial interest, but indeed is diligently observing that fiduciary duty to a client who actually has concrete interests that can be identified and protected. These past few months, of course, we've heard about securities class action lawyers who have forgotten that fiduciary duty. The cases of William LaRocque and Melvin Weiss have shed light on a sad practice which has revealed the fact that basically secret agreements have been entered into with the class counsel and the class representative in a way that ultimately shortchanges the very clients, the class that this class counsel is supposed to diligently represent. Of course, it's pretty simple, the arrangement. The lead, the class counsel agrees to compensate the lead class representative in some sort of way that will persuade them to overlook this abuse of the fiduciary duty to the rest of the class. Thus, the lawyers are overcompensated for their services, and the class representative receives a disproportionate share of the proceeds of the litigation. And, of course, since this was made secret to the rest of the class, they, of course, had no idea that they were actually receiving less than they should have under the settlement. The sad irony is that the securities class action litigation system, whatever its faults, is actually designed to protect ordinary investors. It's for their benefit that the litigation is pursued. Both the proponents of stricter securities liability and the plaintiff's bar frequently invoke the ordinary investor, the hardworking couple saving for college or for retirement, when they make their arguments, and appropriately so. That is the individuals for whom the litigation is brought. But these were exactly the people that were victimized by leading members of the class action bar in this case. One of the leading newspapers in my home state, the Dallas Morning News, appropriately called it, quote, one of the dirty little secrets of securities fraud cases, kickbacks and other secret arrangements that provide a pile of cash to lawyers and far less to supposedly defrauded ordinary investors. It's awful enough that ordinary people are defrauded without greedy lawyers abusing them in the system. Now, it sounds like a little bit of piling on. I mean, I think we ought to distinguish between ethical lawyers and unethical lawyers, and they certainly seem to attack this issue with a lot of enthusiasm. But what we're talking about here is bad conduct, not all lawyers or all plaintiffs' lawyers. While we would all like to believe that this is just an isolated couple of incidents, the work of just a few bad apples, unfortunately, I don't think the evidence will allow us to reach that conclusion. Mr. LaRock himself, apparently feeling no remorse for his crime or its victims, told the Wall Street Journal that basically what he was doing was industry practice. Of course, this is not the first time we've seen these kinds of problems. Back in 1995, in response to an earlier generation of scandals, the Congress passed the Private Securities Litigation Reform Act. Before that bill, that legislation became law, the first plaintiff to file suit was often designated as the lead plaintiff with the power to, of course, hire counsel. The PSLRA sought to end that abuse by class plaintiffs' firms who essentially kept a list of professional plaintiffs with small holdings in every company under the sun who could conveniently be called forth if a lawsuit was indicated, thus winning the race to the courthouse and making sure that they were the ones who were hired whenever a company's share price dropped for some reason. Among other things, the PSLRA designated the lead plaintiff as a class member with the largest financial stake in the case. The theory was that the largest shareholder would be the plaintiff and thus the most capable of looking out for the whole class's interest in the lawsuit. It did help minimize abuses in the system and help secure better representation for the class as a whole. But now we simply are learning that there's just too much money in this type of litigation, and it's just too tempting, apparently, to the unscrupulous to be easily deterred from taking advantage of the opportunities. It's apparent that for some, their fiduciary duty to their client is not enough to ensure that all class members' interests are fully represented and protected. So I believe more court supervision is required. I know it's maybe a little unusual standing here before members of the Federalist Society advocating for a bill that increases the power of judges, but as one of my favorite jurists of the 20th century, a Texas Supreme Court justice named Cornyn once wrote, he said, "While the trial court generally plays a relatively detached role in most civil proceedings, in a class action, the court is the guardian of the class interest. Trial court bears the burden to police the proceedings to minimize conflicts of interest and primarily to protect absent class members." Now, that's why I've introduced the Securities Litigation Attorney Accountability and Transparency Act, quite a mouthful. But this bill is designed to shed needed light on the attorney hiring decisions for the class while also in introducing a competitive bidding system, which will hopefully make sure that the actual client gets maximum value. This will give smaller class action plaintiffs the information they need in order to ensure that they are being fairly represented and fairly charged, and that the money that should go into their pockets is not diverted into those who might take advantage of their lack of sophistication or knowledge. And it will give the courts the power to institute a competitive bidding process to make sure that the fee arrangements between the lead plaintiff and the lead attorney give every class member a fair value and equal justice. It would require sworn certifications from lead plaintiffs and their attorneys disclosing, A, any payments or promises of payment made by the attorney to the class representative in connection with the action. It would also provide that any other legal representations of the plaintiff by that lawyer, any campaign contributions the attorney has made to any elected official with authority to retain counsel for the plaintiff, and any other conflicts of interest. This disclosure would help remove the veil of secrecy from arrangements that have in the past covered kickbacks to the lead plaintiffs by the lawyers who retain them. These secret arrangements divorce the interests of both the lawyers and the lead plaintiffs from the interests of the class as a whole. And my hope would be that full and complete disclosure would prevent the situation from reoccurring. This bill would also allow courts, as I mentioned, to employ a competitive bidding system as one of the criteria in the approval of the lead class counsel. Currently, courts defer to the lead plaintiff's choice of class counsel after reviewing the prospective lead counsel's prior work on the case, experience, knowledge, and so forth. This bill would allow the courts to consider the prospective lead counsel's fees and give the courts the power to solicit competitive bids so those fees are truly based on market rates. Class members deserve to be represented at a reasonable fee. Money that goes to lawyers is money that never makes it to the ordinary investor who this litigation is designed to protect. Currently, courts review attorneys' fees for reasonableness before the fees are paid at the conclusion of the case. This provision will allow courts to negotiate a reasonable fee at the threshold of the litigation. Inserting some market corrections for the process of attorney hiring is one way of protecting the litigants from abuse by their own lawyer, as well as ensuring quality, cost-effective representation in these ordinarily huge lawsuits. Finally, my legislation would commission a study of the last 5 years of fee awards and security class action to determine the average hourly rate for lead counsel. Now, I know this is going to irritate a lot of class action lawyers who just don't like to even talk about what hourly rates should be, but this is information that I think the courts may, and certainly litigants may, find useful. The courts may be able to use this information to rein in excessive fees where they find those fees to be excessive. It's important that corporations, of course, be held accountable when they cheat ordinary shareholders out of their hard-earned money. But it's equally important that the lawyers who represent the class be held accountable when they do the same thing. These recent kickback scandals ought to spur Congress to action, especially because, at least according to Mr. LaRocque, defrauding shareholders has become industry practice for some in the business. We all know that if any industry other than the trial bar were to engage in this kind of practice as an industry practice, there would be widespread outrage, no doubt, in congressional hearings and more than a little bit of grandstanding. And yet the silence we've heard from the majority of the Congress in reaction to the Milberg-Weiss scandals has been deafening. The Securities Litigation Attorney Accountability and Transparency Act aims to break the silence and to prevent these crimes and abuses of the fiduciary relationship between lawyers and their clients, and to try to protect the investor victim who deserves to be protected. My hope is that the transparency and accountability introduced by this bill will provide as a way to prevent some of this corruption from reoccurring again. Corruption can only grow in an environment that lacks the sunshine of transparency and the open space provided by market competition and accountability. A more open and competitive process overseen by a judge who's making sure that the class's best interest is taken to heart will help prevent future scandals. Without this kind of openness and accountability, future scandals are, it seems to me, inevitable. As members of one of the nation's leading legal associations, I hope you'll agree with me that these reforms are important, that we ought to do what Congress usually does when dealing with important matters. We ought to have hearings. We ought to call witnesses before the Judiciary Committee of perhaps whatever the multiplicity of views might be, and that we might learn and perhaps even improve, learn from them and perhaps even improve this legislation. And then we ought to do what the Judiciary Committee usually does, is vote on the bill in the committee, and then it goes to the floor of the Senate where it's open to amendment by members, and then we ultimately vote it out of the Senate, match it up with hopefully the corresponding bill that's been introduced by Jeb Hensarling from Texas over in the House, and then we'll have something I think we can send to the President that we can be proud of, and that also will help correct the kind of abuse that we've been discussing here today. Well, thank you for listening, and how about a question or two? Thank you. And it doesn't just have to be about this. I'm glad to listen or respond to any questions you may have.
Thank you. Thank you, Senator. My name is David. I'm a solo practitioner here in Washington. I did a quick analysis of your bill. I compared it to a bill that was introduced 2 years ago in the House. It's pretty similar, also four sections. And one of your sections borrows language verbatim. However, I noticed that the more interesting section of the House bill 2 years ago was the section called Losing Plaintiff's Attorney's Case, and you don't have that section in the bill. I was wondering why that is.
Well, loser pays is certainly something that I've supported in the past in other contexts. I guess I felt like that probably would, given the current composition of the Congress, probably be a bridge too far. I think that's perhaps the most succinct answer I can give. But here again, like I indicated, if the mood of the Congress is that we ought to add that, there's certainly plenty of opportunities on the Senate floor and the Judiciary Committee to consider amendments to include that. Yes, sir.
Paul Camo of the Washington Legal Foundation. Appreciate your legislation. Our foundation does a lot of work on these class action cases.
Sure.
And I've screened the bill all about disclosure, which I think is needed from my own health advice. But part of the problem also is they were indicted and maybe they can keep that settlement to their claims, but also to stock over who referred clients over to them.
Yeah.
Would your bill cover that, or do you consider covering not only to kickback to the clients, but also to stock over? And also, I think a large problem here is that your bill addresses this and could address this, is that we already have the SEC who goes after the fair funds provision to get funds returned back to the shareholders. But we see a lot of times there's a private bar piggybacking on the SEC work. So it seems to me that our tax dollars are already paying an agency to be doing this job, and why we need to have these opportunistic lawyers here in the first place.
Well, to the first question you raised about money that goes to stock to brokers. Obviously, there's laws in place that make that illegal, for which these individuals were indicted and convicted. This was designed to be more narrow and deal with the fiduciary duty owed by the lawyer to the class, and to make sure that the fees that were agreed to were market-based. As far as the SEC is concerned, of course, this does not attempt to change existing law from the standpoint of a private cause of action over and above any administrative action that the government may or may not take. So it is not as sweeping as perhaps you'd suggest, which would be to eliminate the private cause of action. As challenging as this would be, I can only bet that would even be more challenging in Congress. So we attempt perhaps a more modest way of correcting what we think are abuses of that relationship and in the costs paid, and provide some transparency there. Yes, ma'am.
Hi, I'm from Arizona. My name is Pauline. I was just wondering, one of the largest shareholders was bought down by the first wife of the parent. Why did it take 20 years for this fraud to be discovered and for something to be done about it?
Well, I don't actually know the specific answer to that, but let me just offer you some thoughts. I mean, generally speaking, class representatives are not chosen for their sophistication. They're, I'm afraid, chosen as a matter of convenience, and maybe because they are particularly malleable by the class lawyer. I mean, that's the basic problem, is that the litigation appears from the outside to be more run by and for the benefit of the class counsel rather than for the interest of the investor who was victimized. So I think you're dealing with a real disparity in terms of sophistication, knowledge, and expertise that just creates an opportunity for abuse that if you were dealing with two people of the relatively same level of sophistication, experience, and expertise, you wouldn't have. That's why the additional oversight by the court and the additional transparency provisions are important, because because even though the class representative may not be all that sophisticated or knowledgeable or expert, certainly the court can be, and other observers can evaluate it perhaps in the light of day, whereas previously these things were hidden from public view, really not discussed, and that information really not readily available, hence the sort of corruption and abuse that we saw. So that's just a thought or two. Yes, sir.
Hi. You were just talking about how the concern was that the plaintiffs, the representative plaintiffs, might not be sophisticated and so forth. And, well, that was kind of the intent of the PSLRA, but what happened after the PSLRA got passed was all the big institutional investors who got locked in as the class plaintiffs went out and they picked these big plaintiffs firms that have a lot of experience fighting over clients. So it ended up backfiring and sending more business to these firms. And how are you sure that you're building the same thing?
Well, I would think one way it would be is to provide that competitive bidding process where a solo practitioner like this gentleman here, if he was could offer his services on the same basis as a large New York law firm could, and the judge was satisfied that he could do the job and do it for perhaps a lesser and more closer to market value price, that he could get it by a competitive bidding process. I think it really kind of opened it up a lot more than it does right now. Well, thank you all very much for having me, and you've got the real expert, Holt, on my staff, who will be here, and I'm sure he'll be able to correct any mistakes I've made or offer some additional explanation. Thanks a lot, Dean.
Thank you. Well, thank you, Senator. We appreciate your remarks. As I mentioned at the outset, we're now going to hear from Holt Lackey and Andrew Pincus. Holt Lackey is on the Senator's staff, and indeed he's the point man on this piece of legislation. Holt, do you want to go first, and then we'll hear from Andrew Pincus, and then after we hear from both of them, we'll take some additional questions.
Thank you, Dean. It's good to be here. I don't have too much in the way of prepared remarks. Primarily, I'm happy to answer any questions anyone has, both during the formal session and afterwards. I can hang around for a while and answer questions, talk about the legislation. We've got copies of the bill over there. One thing that I do want to address is I hear in a lot of your questions, and I sympathize very much with them, why aren't we going further right now? And there are just endemic problems with the securities class action system, and there's no doubt about that. But for one thing, we do not control the agenda in the Republican Party right now. It's very hard to get any Republican idea before a committee, much less onto the floor of the Senate or the House. That's the sad facts of the state of play right now. And secondly, because of that, I think that we took extra care to draft this bill to be as reasonable and as narrowly tailored to the problem at hand as we possibly could. And when you think about any analogous situation where a class action lawyer is basically representing a broad swath of the public, and the plaintiff's bar is very quick to say that they are public interest lawyers, and particularly in a class action case, the plaintiff's lawyer who's representing thousands of investors, most of whom are not in the courtroom, the plaintiff's lawyer serves a quasi-governmental role. And any other place where a person is hired to serve a governmental role, a government contractor, if you will, you're going to have competitive bidding. I mean, setting aside whether or not this bill is tort reform, this bill is sound and necessary as a matter of civil service reform. And I think that's the way that we're trying to look at it, in a way that the Democrats who are running Congress right now ought to be able to sympathize with. With that, I'll turn over the microphone to Andy Pincus.
Thank you.
Thanks. Thanks, Dean, for inviting me. I thought maybe I would pick up on Paul's question about sort of the broader context in which this issue arises, because I think a little understanding about the securities class action system and how it works really drives home why it's so important to do what Holt said in terms of realigning, the senator said, in terms of realigning the incentives so you've got lawyers who are actually trying to look out for their clients as opposed to just institute litigation that's primarily beneficial for them. And what's interesting, if you look at the scholarship of the past, really since the PSLRA was passed, there's now quite a broadly held view, and not just amongst academics who are Federalist Society members, that securities class actions just don't make much sense. Let me just give you a couple of quick quotes. Joe Grunfest, who was an SEC commissioner and teaches at Stanford and is probably one of the most prominent members of the academic securities arena, says, "The securities class action fraud system is broken. It fails to efficiently deter fraud and fails rationally to compensate those harmed by fraud. Its greatest proponents are the class action counsel and others who profit as a consequence of the irrationally large damages exposures generated by the current regime." Don Langevoort, who's a member, also worked at the SEC, and quite a middle-of-the-road professor at Georgetown, says, "If the class action system were sold as an insurance product, consumer protection advocates might well seek to have it banned as abusive because the hidden costs are so large." And just one more, or two more maybe, Jack Coffey, who teaches securities law at Columbia and is probably, in terms of his views, one of the biggest boosters of private litigation, says securities class actions impose costs on shareholders to compensate public shareholders. This is a circular process whose perverse effects are compounded by the fact that public shareholders tend to be diversified and thus are on both sides of the wealth transfer. And on each such transfer, a significant percentage of the transfer payment goes to lawyers of other agents. And then finally, from a piece by two law professors, including Jim Cox at Duke, who's also someone who's quite closely identified with the plaintiff side of securities litigation, says many defrauded beneficiaries are not compensated for their losses, while others are unjustly enriched, and many investors are systematically deprived of any benefits from settlements. These mismatches raise serious doubts about whether securities fraud class actions can be justified as compensatory mechanisms. So, you know, it probably wouldn't surprise you that Secretary Paulson and Glenn Hubbard, who was the chairman of the council's the President's Council of Economic Advisors, and other more conservative members of the Academy have those views. But it's pretty amazing when you hear those kinds of statements from people that reflect such a diverse set of views. So this is a system that the more it's been studied, and one thing the PSLRA did was to provoke a lot of study, the more people say it's just sort of wacky in terms of the basic economics. And, you know, let me give you two examples. One is this circularity point that Coffey referred to in his quote. What happens here, of course, is you've got one group of shareholders, the people who bought or sold the stock and are in the class, suing the company, which is really just another group of shareholders, the incumbent shareholders. And so the whole name of the game here is to transfer money from one to another. Often, by the way, people are in the same, if they're buyers, they're in the same, they're transferring money to themselves, which huge transaction costs, not just the plaintiff's fees that you hear about. Some of my partners don't like me to talk about it, but, you know, the defense fees are not chicken feet either. And when you add on top of that the experts and the cost in terms of company time, you've got a huge mechanism in terms of these gigantic costs that are being taken out, and, you know, maybe a little dribbles from one group of shareholders to another. And the real question is, does that really make any sense? Why are we doing that? So increasingly what you've seen is the academics saying it doesn't make any sense. And Coffey has a great quote. He says that this system is the same as punishing the victims of burglary for their failure to take greater precautions. And it's just sort of crazy to have the current shareholders paying for what is always management or directors or someone else's fault, especially when you're talking about billions and billions of dollars of potential liability. I think one of the things that makes these cases, as the senator alluded to, so attractive and so incredibly expensive to litigate is the average damages claimed are now routinely in the tens of billions of dollars. And, you know, when you're doing that, A, you're going to spend a lot of money on lawyers, and you're going to get a lot of management time diverted away from what the company should be doing, which is building value for the shareholders and for the economy generally. So really doesn't make much sense. The other thing that there's been increasing focus on is competitiveness. Nobody else in the world has a private litigation system the way we do. And nobody else in the world has the gives plaintiffs the ability to bring these huge class actions and to aggregate these claims without any checks for filing a claim that doesn't make sense. And so, interestingly, you've had a lot of focus from a number of studies recently on, you know, so what are these effects on competitiveness? What does this mean to the system? And interestingly, Mayor Bloomberg and Senator Schumer, you know, again, not people you routinely think of as, you know, people who are going to be on the pro-business side of an issue that you know, pits businesses against trial lawyers, commissioned a report for McKinsey on the competitiveness of the U.S. capital markets, obviously something very, very important to New York City. And one of the things that report found, and I'll quote again, is the prevalence of meritless securities lawsuits and settlements in the U.S. has driven up the apparent and actual cost of business and driven away potential investors. One of the things McKinsey did was talk to a lot of CEOs of companies that are listed on U.S. markets and companies that aren't, and they found that one of the very top reasons for companies deciding not to list in the U.S. is they just think our litigation system in general, and especially the securities markets related litigation, is so crazy that now, when we've got deep capital markets that can be accessed to London or Hong Kong and increasingly in other places, they say, we don't need the aggravation of coming to New York. We'll go someplace else. And the consequences of that for our economy, for the competitiveness of our markets, for jobs, are really significant. And something that I think, again, people are paying increasing attention to. So I just wanted to sort of give you a little bit of that more general background. And the other thing I think that someone mentioned is this question of the SEC. A lot of 30 or 40 years ago, you might have been able to make an argument that the SEC was sort of a low-key operation, and the SEC followed the private litigation. You know, private plaintiffs would file a lawsuit, and then the SEC would start an investigation. The SEC didn't have staff. It wasn't that aggressive. Well, times have really changed. The SEC in recent years has expanded dramatically in terms of its staff, and you now have exactly the opposite situation, as someone said. You've got plaintiff's lawyers watching the SEC and saying, oh, the SEC seems to have started an investigation here. We'll file a lawsuit, and then we'll just piggyback on their results. So in terms of the two purposes of the system, deterrence and compensation, it makes no sense. There's no incremental deterrence because what executives are scared of is the government. They don't mind going to the country club or wherever or having dinner with their colleagues or their members of their board and saying, oh, gee, we had to settle a class action. There's no badge of infamy in that. If you're the subject of a government enforcement action by the SEC or a criminal action by the Justice Department, that's serious stuff. That's what you want to avoid. That's what's going to deter you from doing something bad, not the threat of a lawsuit that is never going to be adjudicated and always is going to be settled. And the SEC now has the power given to it by Congress to create funds to compensate shareholders. So if compensation is what you're worried about, the government could do that too. So you not only have this irrationality of the private system, got a much more vigorous public system, and it really makes you think that in that environment it's so important to make sure that the plaintiff's lawyers are focused on what's in the interest of their potential clients, because a lot of times it's not the litigation. Anyway, happy to answer questions.
Nothing at this stage. Again, Senator Cornyn's bill is pending in the Senate, and Representative Hinterlings is pending in the House. But at this point, we have not. Both are, at least in the Senate, it's actually in front of the Banking Committee, which, when Phil Graham chaired the Banking Committee, was an extremely good thing. Again, there's very little that can be done to get it on the agenda other than, I guess I'd say, write your congressman. And if you're from D.C., write all of them. Yes.
Just to follow up on that question, Congressman Boehner and Lamar Smith on the House side have called for hearings on the whole Dilbert Weiss case. My question, why did it take so long to get this number exposed? Has anybody in the Senate at least calling for, even though the Democrats are working the shop here, but if you can put that out there and say, we want transparency here in the investigation of this whole
thing? I think that's an excellent idea. I will look into whether anyone is and push forward with the idea of doing so. I would encourage that. One thing I also, this isn't responsive to a question, I wanted to respond to something Mr. Pincus said. I think that to the extent that this litigation may or may not make any sense at all, at a minimum, as a first step, we should make sure, given that it is lawyer-driven litigation, that the lawyers are compensated in a way that is proportionate to the value that they add, if any. And by allowing competitive bidding and giving judges control over, you know, what is it that Milberg Weiss is really bringing to the table here, and is it worth $50 million to anyone, the class members included, by scrutinizing that, we at least get where they're compensated in terms of what value they're adding, if any, and if they're not adding any value, you know, presumably they will not be long in business.
Other questions?
Let me ask a question. Many professions are proud to be self-regulating. The legal profession, of course, is no exception. The ABA propounds rules. The state bars adopt their own versions of those rules, often the model rules from the ABA, and then enforce them. There is a rule requiring that attorney's fees be reasonable. Where is the ABA on this issue? Where are the various state bars in terms of enforcement?
The one thing I know in the securities context is that currently judges, as Senator Cornyn mentioned, do review the fees at the end of the case, right before the lawyer gets paid. The judge then says, was this reasonable? Of course, at that point, an entire settlement has been reached, and the proposition the judge is really being asked is, do you blow up this entire settlement just because the lawyer's getting overcompensated? And most judges, when they have a chance to dispose of the case, will not do any real scrutiny at that point. And you can probably answer as far as the self-regulating better than I do, but essentially that is generally a matter that a lawyer has to decide on his own, and it's relatively rare that a complaint would be filed for something like that. But if you have more to add.
Yeah, I'd say two quick things. I think, as Holt said, the problem for the judge at the end of the case is no one wants to upset the apple cart. And there's no, the way our process works is when judges have competing presentations. No, it's very difficult for a judge presented with a pile of paper with hourly charges by lawyers and some description of what they do to say, oh, I'm going to, I think, you know, this was too much or that was too much. The way it works in when there are, in other contexts where the fee comes out is in addition to the settlement or the judgment, is you have often the government saying, you know, those hours that you work don't make sense, or this rate that you're asking for is way higher than the market rate for these services. You need somebody, you need that crucible of competing advocacy to help the judge decide, and there's nothing there. The judge got one pile of paper from the plaintiffs and nothing from the defense because they don't want to do anything. And so that's why, interestingly, there was a hearing on this issue in 2006 in the House, and Vaughn Walker, who really came up with this competitive bidding idea, who's a judge in California, said, I came up with this idea because at the end of the case, I had no idea what to do. And the only way I could think of making sense is make people compete at the beginning. I think the state regulation, first of all, I think you do need a complaint, and you don't have a lot of complainers generally. But I think more fundamentally, you know, that regulatory system grew up in a world of sort of individual cases and the more conventional litigation and lawyer-client relationships we think of. think as the senator said, this is such a very different kind of litigation that a lot of the models that on which those rules are based don't really make a lot of sense. And you need the judge, you need a much more active overseer to look out for the interests of these clients because they're not there.
But any further questions?
Yes, sir.
Do you think in the end, effectively, this will cut back on the amount of litigation in regards to the competitive bidding system? Because it seems like that would almost undermine many of the business models of some of the firms that actively pursue plaintiffs to bring cases, and they pretty much use a cookie-cutter model to bring similar types of cases. And so if you make them compete for that plaintiff when they go to court, would they even have an incentive to bring a complaint to begin with? So, in essence, what kind of opposition are you seeing from the plaintiffs firms, and what are your prospects now? What are you looking forward to in the next few months before the election?
Sure. Who wants to take that? My guess is the opposition is fierce from the plaintiffs.
I would agree that, yes, the opposition is fierce from the plaintiff's bar, but I do not think, as many of the questions have rightly hinted at, that this is not a piece of legislation that's intended to be a death knell for securities class action litigation. The competitive bidding process would occur early enough in the litigation that there wouldn't have been a lot of sunk costs at that point. It's not as if they're building up the entire case and then you get to the point where you have the competitive bidding process. This is before they're ever named a class counsel. So would it create less of an incentive for big plaintiffs firms to go around ginning up strike suits? Yes, it would decrease the value of being first, of being the first one to talk to the largest shareholder. But it would still be a profitable business to be in. When you look at the amount of money that Milberg Weiss has made over the course of their 30 years of domination of this, I think that simply adding a little bit of competition and breaking up the monopoly would hardly destroy the industry. Yes?
I just wanted to comment on what Andy was talking about in terms of the way it is now, the judges do generally, because both sides agree that it's hard to take that down. I mentioned earlier our foundation is involved in these cases as objectors, representing objectors. The problem we see a lot of times is that the application is made on the eve of the settlement hearing, and in many cases, the objectors have to file their objections before the attorney who filed their fee application. It makes no sense at all, and yet the rules in effect allow that to happen. We try to extract the information from the attorney beforehand so that we can make an intelligent and informed objection. So it seems to me that one rule that the competitive bidding is good is would be to have, in the meantime, some rule that would say you have to file your fee application 60 days before the objection is due or the hearing, so that objectors can immediately go through this, sit through it, and become an objection that can talk things out. And finally, on the issue with respect to this being the competitive bidding, this has been experimented with, I think it's a good idea. But in terms of using the percentage in terms of what the settlement is going to be, in the aggregate, but a lot of times that money can only go back to the shareholders if they make a claim to get compensated. And what we see a lot of times is these forms are so complicated, people get notices that are micro print within the mail, they don't even get notices, and a lot of times no one files these claims for money. So the attorney goes in and says, well, on paper, we're only asking for 20% or 18% of the aggregate. So when you actually see how much money actually goes back in the pocket of the shareholders, it's very small. So I would think that part of your bill, you have to study what the hourly rate is to see also what amount of money actually went back to the shareholders to compare what value the attorney has got for that. There's no incentive for them to make sure that the forms are viewable, that they get out at a time to the class.
Well,
both sound like very good ideas. I think I will, that said, I'll defer to Andy as sort of the practitioner on the panel to
And if you don't mind using the mic.
Sure. Well, it's actually an interesting thing. So securities class action settlements are different than class action settlements in other areas because they're not sort of on a claims made basis. In a lot of areas, they used to be that, you know, there was $100 million or $10 million, and the percentages would be whacked up based on who applied, and if there was money left over, it would be either refunded to the defendants or it would go to some charity that the parties or the judge picked. And in the securities litigation area, the lawyers got nervous that that just this problem would arise. The denominator to which their fees would be compared would start to shrink if a lot of the money got given back. So now the way it works is it's all of the money is given to the claimants, and it's just a question of how many claimants there are. And the fewer claimants, obviously, the more that each gets as his or her proportionate share, but it all gets given out, unlike in some other consumer and other class actions where that's not necessarily the case. But one, I agree with Paul. I think this question of transparency is a very interesting one because this securities class actions are always portrayed as, you know, getting these great victories for real people. And there's a suspicion by many who are practitioners that the number of people who actually seek the money, because it's complicated and the amount each person gets isn't a lot, it's a pain in the neck and you don't have the records, are quite small. And I think one interesting question is whether it's worth having some sunshine on exactly, you know, not the names, obviously you want to shield people's identities, but, you know, who, how many people apply, and are they all really big institutions? And so are we really talking about getting money back for big institutions who can computerize their claim process and not for the, you know, Mr. and Mrs. America who are portrayed as the beneficiaries?
Any further questions? If not, Mr. Pincus, thank you very much. Mr. Lackey, thank you. Thank you all for coming, and we'll see you next time around.